Abraham, or not Abraham, better move forward just a little bit. Joseph has revealed himself to his brothers. And as he's revealed himself to his brothers, he's finally come to this place where there's an overwhelming sense of, I've got to do this. Do you remember, as we studied last week, what was the, I guess we'd call it the event or the breaking point for Joseph? What brought him to the place where he finally decided, I think we're okay. I think I can reveal myself to my brothers now. What was the thing that really just finally tugged at his heart so that he was willing to do that? Yeah, Judah's plea. And what did he? What was he willing to do? Remind me about that.
He was willing to basically
sacrifice himself. Yeah, he had come to the place where he was keeping the promise that his he had given to his father Jacob. And when they went back from Judea down into Egypt again, and they were going to take Benjamin. That whole scenario where he looks at his father and he reasons with his father who is being unreasonable. He is allowing his emotions to keep them from going back to ask for grain again. And as he does that, it is really at a point where they're almost desperate because they need food or they're going to die. And his father has such love for Benjamin that he's not going to let them go. And the choice is, in essence, he's either going to die because we don't have any food, or he's going to die because you send him down and there's a chance he'll live if he goes down and we show that we do have a younger brother. And when Judah finally comes before Joseph and says, look, I made this agreement with my father, and so I'll change places with him, but please let him go home. And it really seems to be the breaking point where Joseph said, all right, I think my brothers are different than they used to be. There's clearly something going on now that wasn't going on when they sold me. And part of that is just they've grown up. But I think part of it is that we see through the whole story how God has worked in the lives of men. And over the course of time, their guilty conscience has just really worked them over. And now they come to a place where they have to make some decisions, and Joseph puts them through the ringer as far as how are they going to come to a place of real repentance, and he brings them to the place where finally he reveals himself to them. And so we've been through the whole story there of a chance for revenge, and now you come to the place in chapter 43 where his distress and his decision to let Benjamin go, and then they go to Joseph's house in chapter 44. Benjamin is set up, and this troubles us a little bit, but we realize that Joseph is trying to accomplish something very specific. And they're even willing to say, yeah, we're guilty, in order to try to keep Benjamin from being taken. There's a stick-togetherness. I don't think that's officially a word, but there's a stick-togetherness about them that they didn't have before. Whereas at one point they, in callousness, sold their brother into slavery. Now here's Benjamin, whom their father loves like he did, and maybe more, tenaciously holds to this younger brother. And they're not willing to separate from him. They see how their sin had hurt their father. And I told you that, you know, there are so many rabbit trails here, and that is one of them. I think that these men saw how their sinful decision had so hurt this parent that there was a real unwillingness to put their father through that again. And some of their statements indicate that. When Judah says, if Benjamin doesn't go back home, what do you say would happen to his father? He'll die. It'll kill him. And he really looks at Joseph and says, you know, you, in essence, will be responsible for killing him if you don't let Benjamin go back home. Because the first time we did it, it had such a heart-wrenching impact. The impact of what children do can so tear the hearts of parents out that you feel like not living. And some of you have been through that with children, where decisions that they've made have been so heart-wrenching that it really just tears at you and you don't feel like living at some point. Well, we came to chapter 45, and when we got to chapter 45, then Joseph revealed himself. Let's go ahead and read the first four verses again, just more to refresh our minds about where we are. And then we'll finish, hopefully, chapter 45 and into maybe, hopefully, all of chapter 46 as well. And that'll move us along fairly well in this. So verses 1 through 4. Bill, you want to read that for us?
I would, but I don't have
a Bill doesn't. Yeah. I'd loan you mine, but they're inside there right now.
Yeah, I can't see
them. Yeah, that's fine. John will bail you out.
Okay.
Yeah. Of course, John's not that much younger than the rest of us. You have your glasses yet?
Mine don't work.
Verses 1 through 4. Okay, what are the two things that he says there that convinced those brothers that he is Joseph? What does he do?
They sold him.
All right. One, he mentions that he sold them. This has not been a topic of conversation. As far as we know, there are 11 guys who know that. 10 of them are there in front of Joseph. The only other one who would know that would be Joseph, and he knew the details of that. Now, he had mentioned that to people in Egypt, but they apparently did not know that. All right, well,
he tells him his name is Joseph rather than using his Egyptian name.
All right, he doesn't use his Egyptian name. I wasn't thinking specifically of that, but you're right, and I think that ties in with the second thing. It's not stated here, but what's that? Well, does my father live? Yeah, there is a compassionate there. He's probably speaking in Hebrew. Yeah. The text does not tell us that, but you would have to imagine that at some point the Egyptian people have gone out, and so there's no interpreter. And all the way through it tells us there's an interpreter, and he sends everyone out, and this guy begins to speak in Hebrew. I mean, I love the whole story of it. You know, that nobody had a heart attack is kind of amazing in the whole thing. And so what he says convinces them, and their natural response is to pull back from him. And so in verse 4 he says, come near me, or come closer to me. And it's the idea that I want to see you and see you a little more up close. And so there is a realistic tendency for them to pull back, because their first thought would be, you know, we're really done now. I mean, if we thought we had problems before, now we're really in trouble, because he can do whatever he wants to us. And he may save Benjamin, send him back home, and the rest of us are in the dungeon for life, if we're lucky. And so there's a problem here. Well, verses 5 through 15 have in it some of the greatest revelation of Joseph's mindset of any place in the Bible. And of all the places in the Bible where you can study what God is doing, and this would be in your life, in my life, in anyone's life, here is Joseph revealing to us the way he thinks in the midst of circumstances that have not been good. And although he's in this position as second in command, and right now things are going really well, he would never have chosen this path. And this reveals to us several things about him. In verses 5 through 8, he's going to bring up a theme that he'll continue throughout the rest of Genesis, the next four chapters, that God's providence is overruling the affairs of men. And then he's going to make provision for his family. And then verses 14 and 15, there's just an inexpressible joy at seeing his family, even though it is under previously adverse circumstances. So let's read through this and just pick out a couple of things here. Verses 5 through 8. Now therefore be not grieved, nor angry with yourselves that ye sold me hither. For God did send me before you to preserve life. For these 2 years hath the famine been in the land, and there are yet 5 years, in the which there shall neither be earing or plowing nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve you to posterity in the earth, and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So now it is not you that sent me hither, but God. And he hath made me a father to Pharaoh, and lord of all his house, and ruler throughout all the land of Egypt. Now, that to me is one of the most striking revelations of a mindset in all of Scripture. Do any of you think this way? I hope you learn to. But we have to learn to think in this manner. Had life been fair to Joseph? Not at all. How many of you has life always been fair to? It doesn't happen. For how many of us has our life gone the way we planned it? Well, it hasn't. How many of us have had something completely unexpected and sometimes devastating happen to us? And I can, you know, look around in here and see people who have gone through devastating things. I know of people who have gone through devastating things. I've told you before about a guy named Phil Kirkland. He worked in the mines, and one morning went to work. He was probably one of the cogs in the wheel of our church up there, as far as just he was a deacon. He was he worked on our buses. He went on visitation. He was just involved and really a sharp guy. Went to work and never came home, and had teenage boys. And that's devastating for that family. Well, here is the same thing, and you would have your own devastation, whether it's a medical situation or whether it's the loss of somebody or whether it's a job. Life sometimes just seems like it comes at you and it's devastating. And Joseph looked at things for some reason completely differently than most of us do. We get mad at God, get mad at the circumstances, we grumble and gripe and complain, and nothing wrong with changing your circumstances when you can. There's no problem at all with that. But we have this attitude that life has to be fair and that everything has to go our way. And we're very guilty of that in the United States. We want everything to go perfectly. We really have an expectation of that. That's not a biblical expectation. And we really need to erase that from our mind, and instead we need to replace that thinking with, God is now giving me an opportunity to glorify Him in a different setting, in a different place. It may not be a place of my choosing. It may not be a place that I would want to stay and would ever choose to stay. But God has put me in this place so that I can glorify Him. Now, I want you to think through two things with me on that. Number one, can you give me an illustration of that in the New Testament as well? I can think of a couple, and so there's not a right or wrong one, but give me an illustration of that kind of thinking in the New Testament. Aaron? Yeah, Christ going to the cross. Here is the contentment again of a man who knows the Lord's will, and God is leading him into something that is not fair and something that he doesn't deserve, but he is willingly going where God wants him to go, even though it is a difficult place, it's uncomfortable, and it is just not fun. There is no sense in which your fun meter is pegged as you go through that. So you're really struggling with that. Mark? Paul's thorn in the flesh. Yeah. When you read about that in 2 Corinthians, Paul said, you know, I asked God 3 times to remove this thorn in my flesh. What was the thorn? Not sure. We think it might have been his eyesight. Yeah. We know he had bad eyesight, really bad eyesight. So we think that may have been what they were talking about, but we don't know. But he finally came to the place where he said, my grace is sufficient for you. My strength is made perfect in your weakness. When you are at your weakest point, that is when I can display my strength. And that is what Paul came to in realizing that he had a physical infirmity that God was not going to remove, but God was going to allow him to be used in spite of it. Give me one more illustration of it. Saw several hands. Ron? Right. Yeah. Yeah. If you remember in Acts, Paul had planned to go to Rome, but he went as a prisoner instead of a tourist. And God orchestrated those things. And on the journey, to whom did Paul witness? Who was it? His guards. You know, when you put a positive spin on it, you know, the guards had to be chained to him. And they would rotate. And so here is God saying, I'm going to narrow down who I want you to witness to. How about this guy? We'll chain you to him. And in about 6 hours, we'll switch and bring another guy in. So it's pretty clear. And he witnesses to those guys. You know, I think of Paul and Silas in the jail at Philippi. They were beaten because they preached, mercilessly thrown in to a prison cell, their hands and feet bound hand and foot, and they could not clean themselves up, and they're at midnight singing and praising God, and the prisoners were listening to that. And in spite of the difficult circumstances, there is a recognition of the providence of God, a recognition of God's leading in spite of the difficulties and the circumstances. And you and I have to begin to think like that. And we're very bad at that because we have this expectation that things will be fair. And we have to come to the place where we see that God has orchestrated things for a reason. Now, there is a flip side to that. And this is a difficult one to go through. Is everything that happens to you simply a result of God's providence in your life? In other words, when something bad happens, is it always God's plan for you? It's a trick question. All right? All right, Mark?
Well, it's more than likely a result of decisions that you make that God will allow those things for your benefit. Nothing happens without God allowing it.
Right. Yes. What do we call... We make sinful choices, and then what do we have? Consequences. Yeah. And there is a line here that is difficult to draw, and Mark hit the key. Nothing happens without God's foreknowledge and God's permission. But if, let's say I make poor choices, get thrown into prison, and I'm thrown into prison because I have, run over somebody because I was mad at him with my car. You know, I ran over him with my car. I wasn't mad at him with my car. And I get put in prison. Well, you know, I have sat down and talked to people who have said, well, this is just where God has me. Well, I always struggle with how do I answer that? It is where you are and deserve to be, but is this where God wanted you? No, he didn't. This is a result of your sinful choice. And so while we look at this and we say, yes, we have to have this mindset of, I am where God has me and the circumstances around me are of God's choosing, there are times that I have to be willing to look at something and say, I'm here because of my sinful choices. I've talked to people who have messed up their minds because of their sinful choices. And it's very difficult to come to grips with those. Now, even if you make sinful choices and you are in, let's use that example, if I make sinful choices and I end up in prison, can God still use me there? Yes, he can. And surrender to him there, his will is to take the next right step. And I never get to the place where God abandons me, but sometimes I have to realize I am where I am because of my sinful choices. And while I would like to say, well, God just did this to me and this is what God has for me, well, that's not accurate in the way that we state it. And most of what we go through is a consequence of poor choices. And so, while I want us to see this side of it, in that you're going to go out tomorrow and something unfair is going to happen. Not of your choosing, not a consequence of sin, specific sin, I would say, but something unfair is going to happen, and you have to, as Joseph says here, realize that God has planned this. God has orchestrated this, and there's a reason for it. At the same time, I have to recognize that many times my circumstances are a result of sinful choices and the consequences of my sin. Therefore, I have to choose to make the right steps from there on. And God is going to, you know, orchestrate things so that I can still serve Him, but it's going to be a different mindset in thinking through that. All right? That make sense to you? All right. A lot more that we could say about that, but let's keep going. Verses 9 through 13. In verse 9, Joseph is talking to his family. He says, "Hurry up," or "haste ye, and go up to my father and say unto him, Thus saith my son Joseph, God hath made me Lord of all Egypt. Come down to me, unto me, tarry not, and thou shalt dwell in the land of Goshen. And thou shalt come near unto me, thou and thy children and thy children's children and thy flocks and thy herds and all that thou hast. And there I will nourish thee, for yet there are 5 years of famine, lest thou and thy household and all thou hast come to poverty. And behold, your eyes see, and the ears of my brother Benjamin, that it is my mouth that speaketh unto you. And ye shall tell my father of all my glory, or my splendor in Egypt, and of all that ye have seen, and ye shall haste and bring down my father hither." Now, I'm not going to linger here on this. I just, two things that as I read through come to my mind. Number one, that, Joseph is clearly still, the dreams were a problem before. Nobody stops him and says, "So, how do you know that there are going to be 5 more years of famine?" I think it's a little interesting that nobody's questioning his dreams now. Secondly, he tells his brothers what he wants them to do. What is the dilemma that they now face? Yeah. They've just gone through this where they realize Joseph is alive, and that's enough of a shock to them. Now he's saying to them, "I want you to go back to our father, tell him I'm alive, tell him of my splendor," and I don't think he was bragging, "tell him what God has done," is the idea, "that we can survive this famine, and then I want you to bring him down here, and everything that you own, all your children, your grandchildren, everybody that you have, bring them down here." This is, again, one of those things where when we begin to talk about forgiveness, that is critical. They've got to go back and fess up. They've got to go back and tell Dad what they did. The slate needs to be cleansed. The scope of the sin is the scope of the confession. They sinned against their father, and they need to clear that up before him. And one of the most difficult things that we have to do sometimes is go to someone and confess something that we did to them that directly affected them, and have to face up to that. And that's what the brothers are now thinking. "I don't really want to do this," but it is necessary for them to get things, get the slate cleaned. And what you have to remember is it's not going to get any worse at this point. Their reputation is not going to be worsened by this. It'll make it worse if they don't deal with it. Just as a side note, do you have to go apologize to someone for everything that you've ever done? All right. What is your parameter for that? Let me give you an illustration. What if I walked up to Bob and said, "You're in the front, sorry, buddy. Yeah. Bob, I've just been wanted to confess to you, I've just been really mad at you. And I've just been hating you in my mind, and I haven't done anything about it, but I've just been mad at you for 4 weeks and didn't like your ties, and you know, your suspenders bother me, and I don't like the shine on your shoes. Do I need to do that?" Not unless I said something to him or to somebody else. Perhaps, I had an aloofness that he knew there was something wrong, but I don't need to bear all of my inner thoughts to people. That is destructive. And if I haven't offended that person, then I probably do not need to approach that. I'm going to create more of a problem, because then Bob's going to be thinking, what'd I do? The next time he sees me, is he mad at me again? No, I can create more of a problem than I solve in some of these things, because people will take this too far. Okay, let's keep reading. Verses 14 and 15. And he fell upon his brother Benjamin's neck and wept, and Benjamin wept upon his neck. Moreover, he kissed all his brethren and wept upon them, and after that his brethren talked with him. There's just a joy of being reunited here, and you could only imagine the conversation. Let me catch up on now, 20 years of the events of life. Verses 16 through 20, he goes on to describe what he plans. The fame thereof was heard in Pharaoh's house, saying, Joseph's brethren are come. And it pleased Pharaoh well and his servants. And Pharaoh said unto Joseph, say unto thy brethren, this do ye, lay your beast, and go, get you unto the land of Canaan, and take your father and your households, and come unto me, and I will give you the good of the land of Egypt, and ye shall eat the fat of the land. Now thou art commanded, this do ye, take the wagons out of the land of Egypt for your little ones, and for your wives, and bring your father, and come. Also regard not your stuff, or don't concern yourself about your stuff, for the good of all the land of Egypt is yours. And the children of Israel did so, and Joseph gave them wagons according to the commandment of Pharaoh, and gave them provision for the way. To all of them he gave each man charges or changes of raiment. But to Benjamin he gave 300 pieces of silver and 5 changes of raiment. And to his father he sent after this manner, 10 asses or donkeys laden with the good things of Egypt, and 10 she-donkeys laden with corn and bread and meat for his father by the way. So he sent his brethren away, and they departed, and he said unto them, see that ye fall not out by the way. All right, here in verse 24, what does he mean when he says, see that ye fall not out by the way? Aaron? Quarrel, all right? Why? Be not troubled, all right? Why would they be quarreling or be troubled? I think this is pretty simple, but...
Whether they should tell their dad or not.
Okay, yeah.
They could have taken their dad down there and said, we need to go back, but they didn't have to tell him it was Joseph until they got there.
Yeah? All right, I think there would be a big... That's what came to my mind even more than that, but I think Bob is right, too. You'd have this real, who's going to tell Dad? And what are we going to tell him? How honest are we going to be at this point? You're definitely going to have some blame shifting. I told you we shouldn't sell him. I told you we should have killed him. Then we wouldn't have to go see Dad. Yeah? Somebody else had a hand. Ron? Okay. All right.
Who gets the blame?
Yeah, who gets the blame here? I just think it's interesting, another piece of the puzzle of Joseph, that he says this. That when they leave, he looks at him and says, now guys, don't get into a fight on the way home. He knows not only his brothers, but he knows the character of people, the sinful nature of people. And I think this reveals to us, that passage reveals how much the people of Egypt loved Joseph, the Pharaoh loved him, and it reveals his insight into the way people think and the way people act. Because his statement to them, don't get in a fight on the way home, is just perceptive about what could take place. Well, let's read the last part of this, verses 25 through 28. And they went up out of Egypt and came into the land of Canaan and unto Jacob their father, and told him, saying, Joseph is yet alive. And he is governor or ruler over all the land of Egypt. And Jacob's heart fainted, or he was stunned, is another way it is translated, for he believed them not. And they told him all the words of Joseph, which he had said unto them. And when he saw the wagons which Joseph had sent to carry him, the spirit of Jacob their father revived. And Israel said, it is enough. Joseph, my son, is yet alive. I will go and see him before I die. Obviously, it's a shock to his system. And he is going to have to deal with this as well. Of all the You know, the rabbit trails that we could take. How do you respond when somebody confesses to you something this drastic? And this is drastic. They have deceived their father for 20 years about Joseph. And now they have to tell him he's alive. How does Jacob respond? Doesn't give us a lot of information, but how do you respond when somebody says that? Where do you go with it in your mind? What are your feelings that you face? How would you respond if you were told that?
I would say I won't believe it till I see him.
Yeah. I would definitely...
Like Thomas.
Yeah. And I think you'd have a reason to. And even there, he said he didn't believe him until he saw all the wagons and things. But these guys have just confessed to lying, and you have to wonder, are they lying again about this?
I think probably the initial response and the joy is it's okay, I forgive you. I think it's, as you get a little further apart from that, that you begin to think, all these years.
Yeah.
And you begin to think about all the nuances of what that means.
Yeah.
And then you have to deal with it again.
Yeah. I think that is a big thing to consider, is that you could be so exuberant about the fact that Joseph is alive and you're going to see him, and the enthusiasm of the, I say moment, but it would have been, you know, several weeks, maybe months, as they made their way down there. But then over the course of time, you begin to mull on and dwell on what these boys have done to their father, and you can develop a lot of hatred. This is a man who has to really deal with a past. And the past is not simply his past, but what's been done to him in an unfair manner by those who are closest to him. They've betrayed him. And you've gone through that. Some of you have. Where you've been betrayed by somebody that you really trusted, you believe. Maybe a family member. We may have a husband or wife in here that has an ex that was betrayed. Here is Joseph, or Jacob, facing that. How do I deal with this? How do I respond when I've been so badly hurt? And initially, we're usually pretty good at it, but it's the long-term dealing with it that is much more difficult. And it doesn't say a whole lot to us about how Jacob dealt with this. We'll deal with it a little more in the next two chapters, not the next chapter, but two chapters later. We'll begin to deal with that a little bit more. But there will be issues that he has to deal with as a result of the fact that he has been so deceived. But what does Jacob's name mean? It means deceiver. He'd had some practice. We're pretty far removed in our study from Jacob, but remember Jacob's history. Birthright, couple of wives in there, children, father-in-law. Deception is not a new thing. And there is a sense in which you reap what you sow, and he has to think somewhere down the road as he considers all this, am I reaping the consequences of what happened in my life? And so there's a lot to deal with in that as well. All right, let's stop there. I wanted to get in chapter 46. That'll give us a good breaking point, though. And next Wednesday evening, we'll go through chapter 46.